This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The neoconservative magazine, The Weekly Standard, is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. Now there's a new book collecting selected articles from those 10 years. My guest, William Crystal, is the founding editor of the magazine and editor of the new book. Crystal was an advocate of invading Iraq. The new book includes an article he co-wrote in 1997 titled Saddam Must Go. We began by discussing the Supreme Court. Crystal told me he's very enthusiastic about the president's nominee, Judge Samuel Alito.
Well, he just has a consistent pattern, I think, really like Roberts and like other leading conservative constitutionalists, of not believing that the courts should intervene excessively, unless it's required by the text of the Constitution, to drive legislative outcomes. He's been deferential to legislatures, local city councils, state legislatures, the Congress as a judge. I think he will continue to do that in the Supreme Court. Obviously, one has to intervene when basic rights are at stake, but I think the courts have gone way overboard in the last 20 or 30 years, and I think a much more limited judicial role is healthy for self-government.
Now, when Harriet Myers was nominated, you wrote a column that was headlined, "I'm disappointed, depressed, and demoralized." What did you do, besides writing that column, if anything, to put pressure on President Bush to withdraw the nomination?
All I did is say that I thought Myers was a poor choice. She didn't have the qualifications, really, to be a Supreme Court justice, or certainly not to be a first-rate Supreme Court justice. And then the more that came out, the weaker a choice it seemed.
I thought that a lot of conservatives weren't confident enough that she would be anti-abortion and weren't confident enough of her conservative credentials.
Yeah, I thought Myers was kind of a wild card in terms of how she might rule constitutionally on the court. And I think it's ridiculous at this stage to put someone on the Supreme Court who doesn't have a well-developed judicial philosophy. If liberals, Larry Tribe has a very different judicial philosophy than Samuel Alito, and he's entitled to say that Alito's philosophy is bad for the country and not the kind of philosophy we want Supreme Court judges to have. That's an intelligent debate to have. I thought the Myers debate degenerated pretty quickly on the part of her backers, actually, in the White House, to a kind of coded appeal to conservatives, don't worry about her philosophy, she'll rule in the right way, which I don't think is appropriate. I'm much happier to have, I think Alito will be a much better justice than Myers would have been, but I also think the debate over Alito will be a much more elevated and appropriate debate than the sniping that we ended up having on both sides of the Myers nomination.
Let me move on to the indictment of Scooter Libby. What's your reaction to Patrick Fitzgerald's indictment and the grand jury's indictment?
I guess I have several reactions. I mean, Scooter Libby's a friend or friendly acquaintance. He's not a close friend, but I've certainly known him for 15 years. We worked together in the first Bush administration. I like him and I respect him, and I'm sorry that he got indicted, and obviously hope, frankly, that he's acquitted in the sense, or hope he's innocent, I shouldn't say, and therefore is acquitted. Obviously, we don't know. We haven't seen his side of the story. We haven't seen all of Fitzgerald's side of the story either. Politically, I think, whatever happens with Libby, I think the opponents of the Bush administration, who hoped this would be a major blow to the future of the Bush administration, I think will end up being disappointed. I mean, whatever happens with Scooter Libby, we're going to have a trial in which one person will be accused of lying about three conversations with three journalists, basically. And there's not going to be brought to court any kind of massive conspiracy to falsify evidence or to or even to out a covert CIA officer if Mrs. Wilson was at that stage.
Well, the indictment is for, lying to the grand jury and obstructing justice. But, the underlying question seems to be, did he intentionally try to discredit Joseph Wilson because Joe Wilson wrote a column contradicting the Bush administration's statements about Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction? In other words, the underlying question here seems to be, or an underlying question seems to be, have members of the Bush administration, or has this particular member of the Bush administration, tried to discredit critics by revealing, in this case, information about his wife?
Well, I think members of the Bush administration are entitled to challenge critics, and most of what Libby and many other people did, and they did this publicly, of course, is say that there were inaccuracies in Wilson's column, which there were. We've reported on them in the Weekly Standard, and that the whole question of weapons of mass destruction wasn't fairly presented by Wilson, etc. you know, in terms of the wife, and that really came up sort of incidentally in the sense of, well, why did the CIA pick someone who was already a vocal critic of the Bush administration to send on this trip? Not an unreasonable question to ask if you're in the Bush White House. And in fact, part of the answer may have been that his wife suggested him for the trip, or it occurred to the other people in that meeting that she was in that he would be an appropriate candidate, and because they might have known him through his wife. In any case, the notion that this was some, you know, well-organized massive smear, I think, is just clearly wrong. The indictment specifies five conversations with three reporters, three with Judy Miller, one with Tim Russert, in which Libby, according to Russert, did not actually mention Joseph Wilson's wife, and then one with Matthew Cooper that's really de minimis. So really what it comes down to is that Libby did apparently tell Judy Miller a couple of times that one reason Wilson might have been picked for this trip was because of his wife, something Judy Miller, incidentally, didn't publish. So that's it. I mean, this was not a massive attempt to go after Joseph Wilson's wife. It may have been wrong to even mention it to the degree they did, and it may have been illegal, and certainly was illegal, if it's true that Libby lied about what he later on lied to a grand jury about what he had said to journalists. But I think the notion, again, that there was this massive conspiracy to go after Joe Wilson's wife just isn't true.
My guest is William Kristol, the founding editor of The Weekly Standard and editor of the new book, The Weekly Standard, A Reader, 1995 to 2005. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Kristol, the founding editor of the neoconservative magazine The Weekly Standard. He's edited a new 10th anniversary book collecting selected articles. October has been the fourth deadliest month in Iraq so far, with about 92 American soldiers killed. An estimated 25,900 Iraqis have been killed or wounded so far since the invasion. And last week we reached the number of 2,000 American casualties in Iraq. Many counterterrorism experts say that Iraq has actually become a laboratory for training terrorists. As someone who strongly advocated the invasion, how do you think we're doing?
Well, I think it was necessary to remove Saddam, and I strongly support that decision. I think we've made mistakes in executing it. I think we're doing better now, and I think we're going to win.
What does winning mean now?
Well, winning means crushing the terrorists, or at least reducing the threat from the terrorists to what is sort of a livable threat. And most of all, winning means leaving a decent, democratic Iraqi government in place so that Iraq is no threat to its neighbors and no threat to acquire weapons of mass destruction, and indeed an example, I think, of self-government and self-determination in the Arab world. And I'm pretty optimistic about that. We've made mistakes, and the Sunnis in particular have been more resistant to being part of a pluralistic Iraq in which their rights would be respected, but in which they would obviously be a minority, and have therefore provided more succor, more support to the jihadists and the terrorists and the insurgents than one would have hoped. But I think they are understanding now that they need to participate in the political process, that we're not going to be driven out, that terror is not going to restore them to preeminence in Iraq. And I think actually if we stay the course for another year or two, I'm pretty optimistic that we end up with a pretty good outcome in Iraq.
In a column you wrote in February of 2002, you wrote that American and alliance forces will be welcomed in Baghdad as liberators. Indeed, reconstructing Iraq may prove to be a less difficult task than the challenge of building a viable state in Afghanistan. Some counterterrorism experts and foreign policy experts say that kind of confidence that many people in the Bush administration had, that they shared with you, that we would be welcomed as liberators, prevented us from adequately preparing for the reality of what we are facing now, which is a very strong insurgency.
We have mostly been welcomed as liberators. Most of the Iraqis are happy that we removed Saddam and happy that we're there, clearly. I mean, we're not fighting a massive guerrilla war supported by millions of Iraqis. Now, I also wished we had gone in with more troops and was critical of the administration at the time for not doing so, and think that would have helped a lot. And there are plenty of mistakes we made in the last 2.5 years that have probably let the insurgency get more traction than it needed to. You get some good breaks and you get some tougher situations. If the war was worth fighting, it was worth fighting at this cost. If it wasn't worth fighting, then we shouldn't have fought it. But this notion that we're going to count casualties each month and say, well, this month there were 92 casualties, and last month there were 76, and next month there might be 110, and then the month after that 65, that's not determinative one way or the other, obviously. If it's worth fighting, it's worth fighting at a cost of 2,000 American deaths. If it wasn't worth fighting, we shouldn't have fought it, even if we could have done so with 400 American deaths.
You know, I think a lot of Americans feel betrayed because this isn't what we were told was going to happen. It's not even what we were told the war was about. I mean, we were told the war was about weapons of mass destruction. You know, we'd be welcomed as liberators, that we weren't told to prepare for the kind of cost that in either money or life that we've proved to be paying.
Well, look, you know, I don't think that's quite fair on the second point. I'll get back to weapons of mass destruction on the first point. There, let me do weapons of mass destruction first. We believed they were there. The Clinton administration believed they were there. The UN inspectors believed they were there. Everyone believed they were there, and Saddam did nothing to prove that they weren't there. So, and he just turned out he was bluffing. It seemed to he thought it suited his advantage to pretend he had the weapons of mass destruction. So I think we went to war honestly, and I don't think anyone at the time thought the weapons of mass destruction weren't there. So I think that's not a fair charge. Now, should our intelligence be better? Sure, but it wasn't really based on exotic U.S. intelligence. It was based on U.N. inspectors' reports and a consensus of the international community, and the fact that he, of course, had weapons of mass destruction. On the second point, you know, the Bush administration perhaps should have warned more explicitly ahead of time that wars are difficult and unpredictable, that you can't know ahead of time how something like this is going to turn out. I think, to be fair to the president, certainly once we were engaged there, that's been his general tone. He ran for re-election in 2004 without promising that it was going to be easy, without promising a quick withdrawal. So suddenly, I will stipulate that everything hasn't gone as well as I would have liked it to have gone, and I'm sure most Americans would have liked it to have gone. And we don't know, obviously, ultimately, whether it will end up, how much it will end up making the world safer or making the world more dangerous. I think if we stick to it and if we prevail, it will make the world a lot more safer. But obviously, some people disagree with that.
Bill Kristol, you are the founding editor of The Weekly Standard, which is this year celebrating its 10th anniversary, and now you've edited a new anthology collecting articles from The Weekly Standard. Before you founded The Weekly Standard, you were chief of staff for Vice President Dan Quayle. What's the difference between the kind of influence you have when you're a close advisor to a vice president and the kind of influence that you have when you're editing a publication that's very closely read in many political circles, particularly in neoconservative circles?
Well, the great thing about editing a magazine or writing for a magazine is that you say what you think and you're not part of a team. You don't have to sort of defend things you think are indefensible. I remember, believe me, lots of times in the last few weeks during the Harriet Myers nomination, I thank my lucky stars I wasn't in the Bush at the White House and would have to either just keep my mouth shut or go out and sort of valiantly and painfully defend something I thought was really a foolish idea. And of course, that's what you do if you're on a team in politics and government. You don't lie for your guys, but you certainly don't tell the whole truth. It's fun editing a magazine where you try to call it as you see it. I don't know how much influence we have. That's so hard to disentangle. If you have influence editing a magazine, it's you put ideas out there, you try to influence the debate, and you never know who's going to pick up what. I found I have a very bad record predicting which of our articles or which of our issues is going to make a difference. Something I think is really important and I think could really change the way people think about some part of the world, you know, kind of comes out and people read it and it kind of goes nowhere. Something else that I personally might have thought, well, this is kind of repeating something we've said two or three times, suddenly catches on. But it's a very good group. I really enjoyed it, I will say. I enjoyed being in government, but it's a different kind of influence, obviously, from sitting in a White House senior staff meeting and trying to make a case for this policy or that. I was Dan Quayle's chief of staff. We were pretty powerless, frankly, within the White House. Dan Quayle, whom I like and respect, and I think he got a bum rap, he wasn't anything like Dick Cheney in terms of influence as vice president, and I sure wasn't anything like Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, in terms of influence as a vice presidential chief of staff. And now with Scooter's indictment, maybe it was just as well that I was sort of unimportant and uninfluential.
Are you feeling a sense of relief?
Well, not quite. I mean, I don't want to feel relief at Scooter's expense. As I say, I've known him and I respect him. I'm sorry for what happened to him. But there is a way in which you, I just never was nearly as central to anything as he's been, obviously.
Well, congratulations on your 10th anniversary, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
William Kristol is the founding editor of the Weekly Standard and editor of the new book, The Weekly Standard, A Reader, 1995 to 2005.